Welcome to episode 54 of The Wolf Den. My name is Jeff Ulrich. I am your host. I am the CEO and founder of Midroll Media and Earwolf, and this is a show about the business and future of podcasting. This is a bit of a relaunch for the show. We haven't done it consistently for a while, and I wanted to bring it back because a lot's changed in the world of podcasting. I have a lot to say about it, and I've really built a bunch of relationships with other people who also have a lot to say about it. So I'm excited for you to join. Our first guest was handpicked by me because he's absolutely perfect for the launch of this new show. He's very much involved in the media world as it relates to a lot of different things, but podcasts specifically. You know him from his own popular show, but I'll let him introduce himself. His name is David Plotz, the editor of Slate. David, welcome.
Hi, Jeff. I'm so glad to be here. I'm honored.
Can I ask you to talk a little bit about yourself for the few people who aren't familiar with your work?
Sure. So I'm the editor-in-chief of Slate, which means I run Slate, a big online magazine. I've been the editor there for about 6 years, and I've been at Slate since we launched it back in the mid-90s. And I also host, along with John Dickerson and Emily Bazelon, the Slate Political Gabfest, which is a weekly podcast about politics that we have been doing for a long time, for maybe
research says about 8 years. It also says that Stephen Colbert said that everybody should listen to you and that you were rated the favorite political podcast in iTunes.
Yeah, Colbert is a big fan. They had a great moment last year where we didn't know he was a big fan, and we posted a show late. We normally post a show Thursday night, but because there was a for some reason, we had recorded it on Friday morning. There was some good reason. So we didn't post it till Friday afternoon. And I was sitting in my office on Friday afternoon, and I get this call. The other end of the line says, "This is Stephen Colbert. I'm calling to complain. You ruined my day. I listened to you Friday morning on my commute, and you destroyed it. And now I don't know anything about politics, and I look like an idiot in my production meeting." And I was like, "This isn't Stephen Colbert." But it was Stephen Colbert. He's a dedicated, dedicated, avid listener, like crazily avid. It's very gratifying.
I was going to say, how did it make you feel to get that call?
It was incredibly gratifying. I mean, he's become a friend, and I saw him this weekend. And what's perfect about it is that he is he's exactly the listener you want, because he's really smart, really critical, really funny. He's obviously can introduce the show to other people. We don't ask him to, but sometimes he does on his own. And it just validates what you're doing. You're like, oh, if the guy who sets the agenda, who is the best person talking about politics, who's the funniest person talking about politics, listens to our show, it can't be that bad. The show has to be like have something to it.
I think that you should be really proud of yourself. It's quite a coup to have him as a dedicated listener and to call in. Have you ever gotten anyone else calling in complaining?
Nobody with a TV show. There are plenty of people call me to complain, but nobody with a TV show. But we have a very dedicated listenership to the podcast among journalists. So I think if you're a political journalist or someone who kind of covers politics regularly, a lot of those people listen to us, in part because we were one of the first podcasts out there,
right?
And because people like John and Emily.
Oh, and they like you too.
Not so much, but that's okay.
Well, I actually, my listenership isn't terribly high, but I was really impressed and flattered after I stopped doing the show kind of a couple years ago. In the months afterwards, I found out that Alex Bloomberg of Planet Money had listened to every episode. Tom Sharpling from The Best Show had listened to every episode. Chris Gethard, Paul F. Tompkins, Aisha Tyler, all these podcasters and stuff had approached me and said, "I love the show. Why'd you stop doing it?" And I had no idea that they were listening. You know, I assumed it was kind of like my extended family and some Earwolf hardcore fans. But it turns out that podcasters are really interested in hearing the conversation.
Well, I think that gets to a larger point about podcasts, which I find so interesting, because people's experience of podcasts is obviously somewhat atomized. You listen on your own. Most people listen on their own. They're listening with earphones on. It's an isolated experience, but it's a very intimate experience. So people have close emotional relationships with podcasters. They really feel close to them because they're right in their ear in a way that even if you're in a car or listening, you know, you're listening to over speakers, you don't feel that same intimacy. But it's also isolated because you don't actually know that other people are consuming that same thing. And we had, what we discovered really by accident is that about 5 years ago, because it was the first Obama inauguration, we thought, well, we're in Washington and it's Obama's inauguration. We know we have a lot of fans who are Democrats and it will be coming. Why don't we do a live show during the inauguration festivities? And so we planned this live show. We'd never done one before. And it was mobbed. We sold it out like in an instant. And we realized, oh my God, there are these people who really connect with us. They're not imaginary anymore. They're real. And so we make a real habit of doing a live show every couple of months, in part so fans can meet each other, but in part so that we are reminded we're doing this for human beings and they want to be with us and we want to be with them.
It's really important for everyone, like you said, both for you guys and, you know, for us. Our comedians aren't necessarily popular all over the world. So if you have a chance to have like 12 people in Pittsburgh who otherwise would never meet because they didn't realize that they both liked Anthony Jeselnik, it's a really great opportunity for them to connect with each other, which is right. is an amazing thing.
Right. So, no, I think that the value of live shows for podcasts is pretty significant. I think what's interesting is that there's also a downside to them. But the upside is obviously you get to see your fans, number one. So that's really important. Your fans get to see each other. So not only do they make social connections, which they often do, they meet each other and hang out, but they also realize, oh, this thing I'm doing is not weird. There are other people like me
who validating. Do
it. It's cool. So that's really important. And they have a great time. It's just a fun evening, in my view. There is a downside, which I don't know if you've heard about this from any of your podcasts, is that sometimes people who are listening at home to live show podcasts almost resent them because they feel like, no, I have an intimate, close relationship with the podcaster, with John and Emily and David, and now they're out there profligately, you know, hanging out with these other people. They're not hanging out with me anymore. They're hanging out with this crowd. Yeah. I'm not there. And so that's like the people that genuinely, I mean, Colbert, in fact, told us he at one point he said he didn't like to listen to our live shows for just that reason. He felt like he wasn't part of that conversation the way he is when it's a studio show and you're together.
Well, it's like Joaquin Phoenix when he found out Samantha had other people, unless she served as an operating system.
Exactly.
It's true, but here's my hypothesis on that, is that it's less that they feel excluded from the conversation because they're not there in that regard. I think it's just there's a lot of stuff happening that you can't tell because it's not – once you have an audience, it could be five people. If you have 100,000 people you know are listening, but there's five people sitting there, you're going to play to those five people. It's human nature. And once that happens, now the audience is no longer the people listening. And I think that they just know that it's not quite the same experience for them.
Right. I heard an interview with Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, about this subject just in the last week. Where did I hear it? I can't even remember where it was. I think it was on a podcast. But he was saying one thing that they did when they made – because that show used to be a studio show and then they took it to a live audience, and they are incredibly conscious that they never do anything that the audience listening isn't aware of. So even the callers are not people who are present in the physical audience. They are people who are calling over the phone, and the live audience has that same experience of hearing them, not seeing them. So obviously, they do it live. So there's some difference, but he really acutely tries to do that. And we're working on that as well. I think we do tend to pander to our live audience.
Well, and I think it's a function both of like who the talent is and how frequent this happens. I think if it becomes like the way you do it, then you absolutely have to treat it as this is for consumption elsewhere. But I think if you're doing like, you know, one show every two or every 6 months and it's for fun and it's really your one time to get in front of your fans, I think it's a lot to ask of people to pretend like the audience isn't there.
Right. Right. That's true.
So I wanted to talk about, like I said, I'm resetting the show a little bit. It's the same show I had before, similar anyways, but I want to focus it on media, specifically podcasting, but media in general, and entrepreneurship. And I look at you as essentially like an internal entrepreneur. You know, obviously you're not Mark Zuckerberg in the traditional sense. But you're someone who is inside a larger organization who's trying to move things forward in the media space. So that's one of the reasons why I thought you were a perfect guest. Now, Slate also, to me, is just a really fascinating organization. You know that I'm very good friends with Andy Bowers, who was also on this show. And I have just no, I don't respect anyone in our business more than I respect Andy. And what you guys are doing to me is fascinating for a few reasons. One, you're kind of coming out of the newspaper space in a way. Two, you're very DC, which is not, in the podcasting world, like you had said earlier, is not a common thing. Yet you're also moving to digital and you're investing in it and you're making a big play. We'll talk about, you know, the Pesca show later. And I think all of these things kind of put together put you in a very unique situation where there's nobody I'm going to be able to talk to who's coming from that starting point of having all of these both like benefits and probably challenges associated where you're starting from. So I wanted to talk to you about that stuff. What is it like to be you, where you're kind of in this leadership slash entrepreneurship position within an organization that's essentially changing every month, it seems, from the outside looking in?
Right. So Slate is interesting in that it's editorially independent. We have a huge corporate owner, which is the company that's formerly known as the Washington Post Company, but is now called the Graham Holding Company. So we're the part of the Washington Post Company that was not sold to Jeff Bezos. But it's a huge, incredibly successful corporation that owns us. We were started out of Microsoft. So we, again, for our first 6 years, we were owned by a huge, incredibly successful corporation. And in some sense, we're this like this strange little island or peninsula in these big corporations because we're not integral. These companies rise and fall without
right.
our profits or lack of profits. What's been interesting is that for the first, so I've been in digital journalism since 1996, at Slate since 1996 when we launched it. And for the first 15 years of it, it was just not a business. There was no business really. I mean, we pretended there was a business, but just didn't work. And anyone who said it did was kidding themselves.
Right.
There wasn't the advertising. There wasn't the creativity. There was no willingness of audiences to pay for things. And in the past 4 or 5 years, we've just had this explosion of this business as a business. And what it's meant is that it's meant that we're a lot less lonely than we used to be. It used to be we were the only people doing kind of what we were doing. And now there are we have tons of competitors. You have both old media places like The Atlantic that have come
right.
super hard into digital and done a great job. You have startups, Huffington Post, you know,
BuzzFeed.
Being one, or Business Insider, or BuzzFeed, that have done tremendously well in the digital space. You know, they're tiny little operations, you know, the individual single person operations that are a challenge. And so that competition has been very disciplining for us, because it used to be it didn't really matter if we made money because it wasn't a business. And there was no metric you couldn't measure yourself against anybody. No one had any good idea of what was growth, what was success, what was failure. Now we can see, you know, BuzzFeed is growing whatever 20% a month, or I just made that number
yeah.
up. I have no idea if that's true. You know, do you have the New York Times, you know, doing this, or CNN.com doing that, or Andrew Sullivan going off on his own and doing his subscription blog? And there's such a churn and such ferment that there's a huge amount of pressure on you, which is great, because now we really have to perform. We really have to be a business, number one. And number two it's very hard to be a creative digital business in a world where there aren't other creative digital businesses. Because, you know, you can think, oh, I'm going to have a great idea and I'll execute it. But really, it takes, you need to spark off somebody else. You need to see things other people are doing and be like, oh, you know, that's cool, but we would do it differently. Why don't we try it way X? And I think that's what's been exciting for Slate in the past few years. So it used to be Slate was it was a slower magazine. It was very straightforward, like we're going to write 1,000-word columns that respond to the news. If we blog, we're going to do it in a particular way. And what we've seen in the past few years is just a willingness to experiment tremendously. So I'm rambling here, forgive me. But the most successful thing Slate has done ever happened last week, which was this thing called the John Travolta name generator.
Yeah,
I don't know if you did it. You saw that? Did you see that?
Joe Altorn or something was mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was this thing which we just came up with the day after the Oscars. So John Travolta butchers Idina Menzel's name on the Oscars, and one of our a video guy for us just said, why don't we do a name generator where you put your name in and it'll give you your John Travolta name.
Right.
And we had a developer who built it in a couple hours, and it went up, and the thing is literally, you know, by far the biggest thing we've ever done. And that I don't know what that shows. I think it shows that you can, and at the same time, you know, so that was the most successful thing we've done this year. Previous, the last most successful thing we did before that was an 18,000 word epic investigative reported story about the woman who Ronald Reagan picked out as the welfare queen of America. And it's her true story, which is an amazing story that one of my colleagues spent 6 months reporting, so that you can go high, you can go low, you can go short, you can go long. And podcasting, I mean, this is a roundabout way of saying getting to podcasting. Podcasting was something which we entered very early because, as you say, Andy Bowers is our executive producer, and we had a partnership with NPR to do a radio show, and that radio show withered, but Andy was like, you know, digital audio is going to be amazing, so let's get into it. So we started podcasting quite early, and we've built an audience, which is, when you compare it to the size, I mean, I hope we'll talk about this a little bit. So the size of the Slate audience as a whole is about 30 million readers. Mm-hmm. The size of our podcasting audience, probably only a couple hundred thousand. Mm-hmm. But those couple hundred thousand people have such good feelings about us, or spend so much time with us, are so devoted to it, are so intense with us, are such willingness to pay, that we are almost building our business around the idea that these are our people, and we're optimizing for them. And so we're going to give them more of this audio content that they love so much. And we're going to think, what do they really like? And that's going to be the basis of almost what Slate as a whole is that, you know, we have to cater to them.
It's funny. My listeners probably at this point are annoyed with how many times I've quoted Seth Godin, but I'll do it again. Seth always says, as a business owner, it's not your job to figure out how to get more customers for your product. It's how to figure out how to have more products for your customer. And that's kind of what you're suggesting, is that you've got this really core group of fans, really, and it's how do we give them more of what they want rather than worry about. I'm not suggesting you're not worried about growing that. I mean, we all want to grow it, but the focus can also be on giving them more, and I think that's a really healthy way to approach it.
Right, and in some sense, if you create things that your super fans like, if you assume your super fans are discerning people, because they are, because we're Slate, then you create things that they like, it actually adds to your overall audience. And what we have seen, the weirdest thing that we've seen, is that we used to think that there's really only a limited potential audience of Slate. Like, it's just, you know, it's really just a few million people. But no, it turns out that the more you publish, the more chances, the more products you create for them, whether it's video, whether it's more podcasts, whether it's new kinds of blogs, whether it's like, for example, we have our most successful new blog is about astronomy. Mm-hmm. Like, who knew? Who would think? Like, oh, Slate goes into astronomy. But turns out if you start publishing really smart stuff about astronomy, you'll collect in a whole category of readers you hadn't collected, and they start reading other stuff. And it's so the bait you build, you have this intense, narrow audience, and it becomes the base, but that base gets bigger and it expands to include, you know, not just 30 million, but 35 million, 40 million.
So let me ask you this. I mean, what you're describing is a lot of the tenets of like a lean startup movement, where it's very experimental and hypothesis, you know, let's test, not being afraid of failure. Speed is your friend. These are not things that you would associate with a company that's been incubated by Microsoft and the Washington Post, that in itself is almost 20 years old. I mean, you guys are like the old fogies of the digital space, essentially.
Yeah, totally.
That's really, really impressive. I mean, I sit here as like Earwolf is not even 4 years old yet, and I worry about like, how do we make sure we don't get stodgy? How do you do it? And I really mean that earnestly. Like, I'm very impressed that you're able to have that type of a culture when it's really hard to do that.
Well, first of all, though I like to flatter myself a lot, I'm not going to flatter myself too much. I think we're pretty good at it. That said, we have huge challenges because we are old. We're like mainstream old mainstream new media. We have been around for 18 years. We have habits that developed. And in a way, the most useful thing that happened to us was about 2-3 years ago, we avoided the first kind of that 2008, 2009. We did not get cratered by that, in part because we weren't much of a business to begin with, so we didn't really lose our business. Right. In 2011, we hit a wall, and we were in really bad shape. And I don't think there was any danger that the Post company was going to shut us down, but there was this sense like, you guys have to make some serious changes. And it compelled a real come to Jesus for us. And we radically changed our business model. We radically changed how we worked editorially. We changed metabolically how quickly we worked. And it was, the result was great. And we've tried to keep the spirit of like, oh crap, we're 1 minute away from disaster in the back of our head, because right. I think that the complacency in this is it becomes you're just totally screwed if you're complacent. If you continue to do the same thing, it won't work. I mean, I think that you, like with BuzzFeed is constantly iterating on its, you know, it's not lists anymore, it's quizzes, and when right. quizzes are burned, it will be something else,
right?
And I really admire that. And but at the same time, sorry, I, this is, forgive me, but at okay. the same time, you constantly have to iterate and change what you're doing and try, but you have to know what you are. So the thing that I think is amazing about Slate, and that every successful business or media enterprise that lasts has, is that we at a fundamental level have not changed who we are, which is that our brand is smart, analytical, and funny. Like, those are the three things. We've been that way. If you look at 1996, that's what we were. If you look in 2003, that's what we were. That's what we are today. Now, the kind of how we go about doing that changes, but that core thing has always been there. And anytime we stray away from it, we get screwed. So like, there was a moment where we thought, oh, we should do more celebrity stuff. No.
Right.
I mean, we just weren't good at it. It didn't fit. We screwed over our regular readers. We're like, yeah, you know what? We don't want so much of that. So I think you have to have this. So you have to both change and be the same at the same time. You have to be the same at the foundation, at the heart, but then you change kind of the limbs.
So that's a great answer. I have two questions here in a row, and it says, what do you think is Slate's position, and then what are the advantages/disadvantages of this positioning? And you answer that. I mean, it sounds like, so in terms of that advantages, disadvantages, one advantage is that you've been around 18 years and that you've been the same thing for 18 years. So you've been growing a brand for a lot longer than most people have.
Right.
And on the flip side, it sounds like you didn't even have, you said before, like you changed your business model. It sounds like what you really did was you started a business model. It sounds like maybe you didn't even necessarily have one before, and you were forced to kind of like start from scratch in terms of the business part of it, which is challenging and refreshing, right? I mean, you got a chance to build a brand basically for free for a long period of time, and then you got to reinvent the business, which to me, that's a huge gift to be in that position.
Yeah, no, I mean, because we weren't owned by VCs, we weren't owned by investors, we were owned by the Microsoft, then the biggest company in the world, and then the Washington Post company, which is this Graham holding company now, which was just a huge, very successful company. And it is a gift. That's a really good noun to describe it. I never thought of it that way, but that's exactly right. Had we been forced to try to be a better business in 1997, maybe it would have been good for us in some ways, but you're absolutely right. One thing that Slate has that very few places have is that we have a homepage audience. People still come to Slate as a homepage. I mean, if you're a Business Insider or BuzzFeed, I don't think very small number of people go to those as homepages. They get referred parts of BuzzFeed, but we have people who are Slate readers. They really think of themselves, and that is an amazing thing to have.
And again, it's very rare. It's not only amazing, it's at this point,
It's totally rare. Yeah.
It's Google, it's Yahoo, you know, it's a few others, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, we're not at that scale, I should say.
No, but I mean, you're right. Funny or Die doesn't have that. Anyways, so Slate, you're investing in podcasting. This is kind of like a two-pronged question. It's, you know, you're investing in podcasting. How is that going? And then as much as you care and want to talk about it, let's talk about, you know, bringing Mike Pesca aboard. He recently just released, or it was released, I don't know if he did it, his goodbye memo to his NPR colleagues. It's getting a lot of attention.
I have not seen that. I haven't seen it.
You're kidding.
Is it great? No.
Yeah, no. It's great. How could you have not seen it?
I haven't seen it. I got to go check it out.
Yeah. Really? It's wonderful. It was like, I won't say anything. I'll let you read it. It was
great.
Really great.
I can't wait.
A, you're investing in podcasting. Is that a safe thing to say at this point?
It is a very safe thing to say. And, yes. So we are. Do you want me to say specifically what we're doing?
Yeah, I was going to say, talk about what you're doing and how it's going and what your thoughts are.
So until about 6 months ago, we were a podcast shop that was Andy Bowers, our one executive producer, and then a bunch of sort of part-time folks who contract engineers and producers. And we produced three or four more or less weekly podcasts, our Political Gabfest, our Culture Gabfest, our sports show Hang Up and Listen, a women's show called Double X that my wife hosts, and then some other smaller things. What we realized is that, as we've been talking about, these podcast listeners are the best fans that Slate has. They're the most devoted. They're the most willing to pay for things. They'll spend time with us. They want to come to events. And we want to have more of them. And also that Andy as you've talked to him, he's an incredible advocate for and evangelist for this podcast revolution that you're bringing, that there are more people are going to do it, that there's going to be a business there.
Right.
And we should be in front of it, not behind it. So he and I have been talking and talking with my boss, and we made the case that this is a place where we can really grow. And so the biggest thing that we're doing is that we've hired Mike Pesca, who was NPR's sports reporter, and he's been a panelist on our sports show for years, but we've hired
him and listen
full time to launch a daily news interview show. Probably it'll be about 20 minutes long, and it's going to launch, I think, in April, so next month. And we're still looking for a producer, so if any producers out there listening, email me.
There was a great job description, kind of like job listing, by the way.
Right.
I really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so Pesca is somebody who we've wanted to work with permanently and for a long time, because he is just a hyper talent. The guy is so smart, so funny, so quick, so agile in every way. And he deserves his own show. And NPR, for whatever insane reason, hadn't given him his own show. And we were like, God, well, we'll do it.
Right.
And let's do it through a podcast. And so it's a daily podcast. And I'm interested in your thoughts about whether, you know, you and I have talked about the frequency that podcasts should run. I'm interested in your thoughts about whether a daily frequency podcast is something that is sustainable.
I absolutely do. With the right person, with a great show, I think it'll be extremely successful. We've had very limited data points on that. You know, from a mid-roll perspective, we work with 115 shows, I think, and a couple of them are dailies. And the growth has been tremendous for those shows. So I think that it's a good place to be with Mike specifically. I mean, I wouldn't just say like, oh yeah, like let's throw, you know,
right.
darts at a wall with a bunch of different shows. But I think this has a real chance to start strong and then to continue to grow.
Here's a question for you. Not that I know you're supposed to be talking to me.
That's
but
okay.
So Pesca will be hosting the show, but he's going to take vacations.
Right.
What do you do? Do you think you sub-host it? You always have to have the show there every day?
That, as a producer, that is my preference. Because I look at it and I say, my number one responsibility is to the podcaster. My number two responsibility is to the audience. And if the podcaster is basically like saying, hey, for 4 weeks out of the year, I'm not going to be a part of this situation, then it becomes my job is to say, how do I make sure the audience gets something good? And so to me, it's a no-brainer. Some hosts love that idea. Some hosts are like, that's my show and I'm not sharing it. And no, we're not inviting anyone to stand in. It's my show. So I think it depends on who the host is. And the last thing you want to do is have a disgruntled host over this. But you know, personally, I think you owe it to the fans to have something good. And then you use it as an incubator. You have an opportunity to then have a different kind of show for 4 weeks, and maybe something works, maybe it doesn't, and maybe it can kind of live on forever then when Mike comes back.
Right. I agree. I'm glad to hear you say that. So Pesca is the big investment, but we're also launching a weekly business podcast that's going to be hosted by Felix Salmon, who's fantastically talented. And it's going to be kind of on the model of our political show.
Right.
We're going to launch, we're probably going to do a couple of different tech podcasts that haven't really been shaped. We have the most popular feature at Slate is an advice column called Dear Prudence.
It's a last question about Slate was, why doesn't Dear Prudence have a podcast?
Good question. Dear Prudence is, you know, that's on the list. We're going to launch a Dear Prudence podcast. I don't know that it's going to happen in the first half of the year, but I think it will happen in 2014. And we've added, Mike Vuolo, who's been was a contract producer for us, and he hosts a great podcast called Lexicon Valley about language.
Right.
So he is going to, he's gone on staff with us, and he's producing a lot of shows, and he's also continuing to do Lexicon Valley, which has been a great hit for us because people really, really like language as a topic.
We're going to take a short break, but we're not going to go away. I'm going to do a live read. Typically, we would like say, okay, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be right back with David Plotz. And then you and I would just continue the show. And then later I would record the spot and we'd put it in. But we're starting to test the performance of reads that are just straight live.
This is really interesting because we do ours straight live. And I mean, first of all, I want to watch the master do it. I want to see mid-roll. I hope you leave this in the podcast. Too,
actually,
number one. Number two, I'm very curious to see, like, why not do it live?
Because the hosts prefer to kind of like get into it when their guests aren't around. To be able to do a couple takes, make sure they get it right, put in their own words. So you're putting me on the spot. We'll leave all this in, but like, I don't know that I'll do this great because it's an internal ad for Earwolf Pint Glasses that I haven't looked at before. And I'm about to kind of just do it on the fly.
Awesome.
I'll probably screw it up and it probably won't be great, but we'll see how it goes. So, hey, everybody, time to stock up on some spring apparel. That sounds so cheesy. I already changed my whole everything. I think the point is to not change if you're doing it live. All right, guys, look, go to earwolf.com. Everything that you've ever wanted out of us is there. We have t-shirts. We have pint glasses. We still have Bob Duca care packages. And there actually might be some news about Bob Duca coming soon. So keep your eyes and ears open for that. We've got deals on all this stuff because guess what? It's March and we had all the stuff we bought for the holidays and some of it is still sitting in my garage. Yeah, David, that's right. Our entire warehouse is my garage. What are you waiting for? Get over to the Earwolf store, go to earwolf.com/store and let's get back to the show. This was really atrocious, by the way. don't forget about the tote bags while I'm at it. Okay. So we're back. So that is what to not do on an ad. So in terms of like the bringing Mike on, I mean, how long was that process? Was this, again, I have no idea how much you can talk about or not, but as much as you can share, illuminate for us what it's like to have a 10-year NPR veteran kind of like become part of a conversation with you and how that went.
Well, so NPR gave us a gift, which is the NPR, again, for reasons I don't quite understand, did a round of buyouts. I guess they were in financial turmoil, and so they made very attractive buyout offers to longtime employees. Mike had been at NPR for a while, and I think this was, if I remember, it was like late summer was when it first came up, and we started talking to him about whether, are you going to take the buyout? What if, you know, what would happen if you took the buyout? And we'd wanted to do a show with him for a long time, and so it sort of kept growing, and we were having the thing that allowed us to do it is that we had a strong enough year financially in 2013 for us to say we should invest more, and so
right. So
our owners said, yeah, you can increase your budget, and so we created the space to invest in this, and we haven't launched the show yet, so I don't know whether it will pay off. I do know that when you think about somebody you, he was the number one person we wanted to work with who didn't work with us already.
That's amazing. And I should have said this at the top, but anything I ask you that, you know, is uncomfortable, just stay. Cause I don't ever know where the lines are sometimes.
I will.
But are you guys in a position where you have to kind of like pay for your own stuff, or are you just in a growth thing where you're like, hey, look, our revenues doubled last year and we want to make this investment and we know we don't have enough money, but we think that the top line justifies it. Are you in a, you got to pay for all of your own stuff, or you get a leash?
We more or less have to pay for everything. We are run as a real business. We're not run for growth. Our owner expects us to be profitable, and we can make a case that this, you know, increasing our budget to add a PESCA will help us in a year, and they're all for that. But realistically, we have to earn back PESCA salary this year. We can't say we're going to earn it back double in 3 years.
Right.
We sort of have to. It's more pay as you go, I guess, is the answer.
That's healthy, I think. That's the way we don't have any investors or any debt or anything. So I think it's a good way to be forced to be sustainable. You got to use your own money to grow. So the future, you know, I said that I wanted to kind of have this show also start talking about what'll come next. You reached out to me, I don't know when it was, a month ago maybe, or 2 months ago?
2 months ago, I think, yeah.
And said, hey, I'd love, you know, an opportunity to chat with you about podcasting stuff. I'm going to talk to a select kind of group of people that I know who are heavily involved in the space and try and learn some things for our own. And I said, like, who's the audience? I actually assumed that it was going to be something that you would release originally when you emailed and you said, oh, it's just for me and Andy. I know that there's a lot of stuff that kind of is very private that came out of that. But for the people for the stuff that isn't private that you can speak to, I think our listeners would love to hear about it. Number one, I think it's just great that you took the time to reach out to people and really digest kind of a lot of different opinions. I think it says a lot about all of us who participated that we're looking to help each other. And that's a great signal to send, I think, to the marketplace, is that, you know, it's a very collaborative environment. And then, you know, how that report and what you kind of learn from that, what does that tell you about where we are? And more importantly, like, where do you think the future is going?
Sure. So just a little background is that I decided if we're going to make this big investment in podcasting, that I need to understand the business a little bit more and be a better partner to Andy Bowers, who knows so much about it. And so I went and I called and contacted podcasters I really admired, people in podcasting I really admired, who was very successful, and said, I'd love to pick your brain about what you're up to. So I talked to people like to Roman Mars or Dan Carlin from Hardcore History, or you or Jesse Thorne and Minion Fogarty, and a bunch of other folks, and said, just tell me about what you're up to. I'm not going to reveal any of your trade secrets to the world. I want to understand, like, how do you build an audience in podcasting? How do you make money in podcasting? And what are the kinds of economic relationships that you can have with the people who do the podcast? What are the potential ways that networks can work? And then finally, what are basic lessons for Slate podcasters that we can use to grow? And the big question for me, it was, from what I can tell, almost every podcaster who starts out, particularly if you start out within some kind of network, whether it's Earwolf or within Slate Network, a place that already has some audience, you start a podcast, you can immediately attract some audience to it by referring people within your network, putting promotion in Slate. So you build a subset of the people who are already listening to podcasts that are related to it. You can attract them to your new podcast. So when we launch Mike Pesca's show, I'm pretty sure that if we'll advertise it on the Political Gabfest, Mike will, you know, be a guest on our show, and he'll quickly, there'll be a group of Slate podcast listeners who will subscribe to it, and that will be solid. It will be a fraction of the number that subscribe to our big shows. Almost every show you can start, you can get an audience, but then you plateau, start growing really slowly. How is it that you can make a transition from being a slow or non-growing podcast to having a real audience that keeps growing, you're keeping adding to. And that was the kind of question that I really wanted to grapple with. And it turns out there don't appear to be that easy answer. But the easy answer is you get Radiolab or This American Life to give you like 12 segments, right, and you get that audience. But really, it's not simple. And it looks to me, and you know, I mean, let me just look at my notes over here.
Sure.
It looks to me that like there are a lot of basic things you have to do kind of for hygiene purposes. You have to be decent at social media. So when you have fans and they're tweeting at you or that you have a Facebook page, you've got to just be respectful, respond to them so that they stay in love with you and they stay attentive to you. So that's a basic thing you have to do.
That's one of the costs of the engagement that you were referring to earlier, is that if you want people who are so engaged that they will go to the live shows and they will support everything you do, then when they want to make a comment about something to somebody, they don't expect to be ignored time and again. I mean, maybe they are okay with like a 1 out of 5 response rate, but yeah, you can't ignore them.
Right. So social media seems important. I mean, I think that this is something that you know a lot more about than I do, because I don't really do any of our deals, but it appears that how you handle your relationship with iTunes and then with the Stitcher or iHeartRadio or other places like that, there are ways to handle those relationships where you can use either your high quality or your scale to get them to give you things that they wouldn't give to a run of the mill podcaster. And again, I would say to you, you tell your audience what those things are. I don't really understand them as well, so you go ahead and tell them.
Well, it's not rocket science. It's just that when you're doing distribution deals where it's kind of like a trade, it's my content for your platform exposure, and there's no money changing hands, which is largely the way it works these days still, all these years later. You know, the people who have, you know, Mark Maron or Corolla, or in our case, you know, Earwolf, we can go and we can say, well, you know what? It's really hard for you to have the podcasting app without WTF or without the 20 Earwolf shows, 15 of which are in the top 100 in iTunes, or you know what I mean, whatever it is, and say, because of that, we want to make sure that our shows are treated as well or better as what any new show would get. We don't want to help you build your platform business off of the backs of our content for no money and then be part of the group that's kind of like cast aside because now you want to attract the new shiny object that's going to propel you even further. So you're able to kind of negotiate terms at scale for Earwolf, or again, if you're Corolla or Kevin Smith or Mark, simply just like, hey, you don't want to not have my show. Now, I can't speak to what anyone else does. I only know the deals that Earwolf does. I assume this about Mark and Adam just because they seem to always be kind of top and center of whatever the new thing is. But you know, Slate is in the same position, you know, where you guys can say like, look, we have a very valuable discerning audience that's, you know, and the people who are going to be attracted to our content are the kind of people that you want on your platform. And what are you offering, rather than just like, oh yeah, send me your template partner agreement and I'll have it back to you in 10 minutes.
Right. Right. That piece of it is very important for growing an audience, because that visibility obviously is a way that new listeners are going to come to you. Then I think you get to the really big category, which is it appears that the major way you build a podcast audience is by being deeply connected in the podcast ecosystem to other podcasts, particularly bigger podcasts. So part of it is obviously regular promotion within the network, your own network, so that the Slate Culture Show will promote the Politics Show. So
right.
Just so that those listeners are pushed to become listeners of both shows. But more, it's like when getting podcasts that may have complementary but not fully overlapping audiences to connect with each other. So, you know, you get somebody who's got a big successful podcast that is like Dan Carlin is a great example. Dan Carlin, if I could get Dan Carlin on a Slate show, And he was able to bring some portion, you know, because he tells people through social media, he's able to bring some portion of his common sense audience or his hardcore history audience
right.
to over to Slate and who give it a try because, oh, Dan's on that show. I want to listen. I love Dan. That would be amazing. Similarly, if John Dickerson, my colleague, shows up as a guest on Dan's show and Dan says great things about the political GabFest, that's going to be a huge growth. And there are a few shows that obviously are big drivers. I think, you know, Marin, the big NPR shows, This American Life and sure. Radio Lab in particular. I mean, Roman Mars, I think, had his audience go fivefold when Radio Lab featured him. I mean, fivefold increase.
That's an amazing thing. That's not available to most of us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You want to talk about gifts? That's a great gift.
Right. It is. I mean, well, I feel that way with Colbert's endorsement of our show. I mean, Colbert doesn't podcast, so it's not quite the same thing. But again, that's a big media thing where the mention of it gets people thinking like, oh, maybe I should try that show.
Yeah.
Maybe I should listen to it. And the great thing about podcasting, as I'm sure you know, is that once you are a podcast listener, you become a crazily addicted podcast listener.
Yeah.
So almost anyone who listens to one podcast listens to three or five.
Yeah, you get the disease. Yeah. I mean, that's why I always say, you know, if somebody becomes a listener of Political GabFest or of Nerdist or of Common Sense or whatever it is, they're one step away from becoming a listener of ours.
Right.
You know, and especially like that's where I think we are able to take advantage of our kind of breadth is that if you go into the iTunes store, you know, it's every fifth logo is an Earwolf show. And so if you're like a newbie and you're like, well, I love this one podcast I just found. What are the other good ones? You know, I've got a 20% chance that you're going to click on one of mine.
Right.
And there's a lot of power in that. Yeah, I think that. So the report, by the way, like I said, just kind of between us and whoever's listening, it was really fascinating. I'm really glad that you did it, and I appreciate you including me on it because it's a great piece of work that you put together in a short period of time, and I think a lot of us got a lot out of it.
Thank you. Well, I may publish a version of it once I get all the secret details about the mid-roll Earwolf business model out of it.
There's no secret details. So we're going to end-ish on question about the growth potential of the business side of podcasting. And then, you know, we talk about innovation and trying new things. I'm actually using my show to try something new. It's something that I've always thought I'd like to see if it would work or not, which is I'm going to lead the end of this show into a short video segment that will kind of live independently of the podcast, but I'm hoping to use each to drive people to both.
Right.
So just so our listeners know, I want them to be interested to go see the video, but you're not allowed to answer these questions yet. We have to wait until we get to the video segment, but, you know, I think I'm going to call it Happy and Bitter Endings. And I'm going to ask you two questions. What is the most exciting or innovative thing that you think is happening in podcasting right now? And the second question is going to be like, what is the biggest challenge, the thing that keeps you up at night regarding our industry? So those will be the two questions I'll ask you after you answer the question. Do you think the business is growing? And if so, where do you think the main emphasis of growth is?
It's definitely growing. Podcasting is definitely growing. The open question to me is the audience for podcasting growing enough from new listeners? Like, it's clear that there is this core of podcast listeners who are listening and listening more and more. And it's successful and you can build a real business off of it. Whether we're able to add quickly to that audience is to me the open question. I mean, we've seen on the music side of it, obviously, they're adding tons of people are getting digital music, streaming music, music in their car, off the internet. They're getting internet radio in the form of music. I don't think we're quite there with the spoken stuff yet. And I kind of assume we'll get there once it becomes really easy to do it in your car. But I'm a little bit worried that we're not as much there.
Here's my question for you. You don't think it's easy to do in your car right now?
I think it's easy-ish. One thing I've gotten into the habit of doing, and I really try to do it. I don't do it as much as I want to do. And I think all podcasters should do it, is every time I meet someone who doesn't really know what a podcast is or doesn't listen to them, I just try to get them the podcast app and subscribe them to a couple of Slate podcasts immediately, just so it's just done for them. But I actually think that barrier to entry is non-negligible. It is not simple. Or like in my car, I had to get a stupid cord, and the Apple compatible cord was hard to find. And then I had to actually fix my stupid radio because Subaru had installed it wrong. So it wasn't that simple.
Right.
It required active work on my part.
Right.
It wasn't simply I have my phone in my car and I just hit something and it's playing through the speakers. It was like a bunch of kefauvery there.
I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, I do think that there are challenges to listening in your car. I don't. The numbers that I've seen, now these are just numbers that other people have told me. It doesn't mean that they're correct. But that, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% of the people currently listen via a smartphone in their car, which was more than I thought, and doesn't make me feel like, oh, well, that's going to get to 75% next year. So while I'm bullish on the car thing being part of a solution to how to grow an audience, I don't look at it as a silver bullet that's going to happen overnight. I think it's going to take a long time to really kind of chip away at that market.
The thing I would say, I guess I agree that it is not the silver bullet. What I think of as the silver bullet is that when you think about how we consume digital media, we're in the constant state of consuming more and more media, and at some point you're cannibalizing. You know, you can't. There is only so much time you have to watch video, only so much time there is to read. The amazing thing about audio, which makes it different than every other media, is that you can do other things while you're doing it.
Right.
And that makes all the difference in the world. And that's why it's additive in a way that
nothing else is.
The video can't be and the text can't be.
Right.
And that's to me the best feeling about it, is that basically once someone becomes a digital audio listener, they never go back.
No, no. One of the biggest challenges for all of us is that we're going to start to see competition from the text to audio industry. And it'll be now people who otherwise maybe were only podcast listeners are going to be trying to listen to their favorite bloggers or read their favorite articles by listening to them audiobook style. And I think it's both a challenge and a boom. You know, like, I think it'll bring new listeners in who aren't going to only want that type of content. And I think it's going to also cannibalize some of the listening time that people spend on podcasts. Again, completely anecdotal, just my own opinion. I think it's a net benefit to us. I don't fear it, but I do think that that's coming, and it'll be a big deal 12 months from now. It's my guess.
I bet you're right about both of those things. And the reason I think that why I'm bullish about the ultimate outcome is that the major reasons that podcasts succeed, at least in my experience, is the emotional connection that you make with the podcaster. It's not really content.
Right.
It's much more emotion.
Right.
And text audio does not create emotion. And straight reads of things does not create that emotion.
I agree.
That's why I'm heartened.
Right. Well, David, thank you so much for being here and for helping me dissect all this stuff. And I really couldn't have asked for a better kind of return to doing the show. So thank you so much. I'm glad.
My pleasure. I hugely enjoyed it.
I'm glad that that Annie introduced us and that we were able to meet, because I anticipate knowing you for a long time. And I hope if you're ever in LA, you come and visit. Everybody can find David over at Slate.com. He's the editor, so everything you see there is basically his. You can listen to his podcast, Political Gabfest. And don't forget now, if you want to hear the answers to those questions that I'm going to do on video and help with this experiment, go to midroll.com and you can watch this short video of David and I talking about innovation and what keeps him up at night. So until then, happy podcasting. Earlobes.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Reza Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.